Okay, so we'll get started. We've got a lot to get through in the next 60 minutes. Before we start, I just warn you that I have had a really bad cold. There's a chance that I might lose my voice during this session, in which case I'll point at the slides and you can all clap when you're finished reading and we'll move to the next slide. Hopefully it won't come to that. I gave this session last week for the .NET user group in Silicon Valley. I got the feedback that it was really dense. So pay attention. There's a lot of stuff coming. It'll be more or less the same session, apart from the Trump jokes. Apparently it was too soon. Yeah. So my name is Barry O'Reilly. I am the chief architect at a company called iDesign, who are based in Silicon Valley. I'm the Europe office. Has anyone heard of iDesign? Yeah, so anyone that's done any heavy lifting with WCF has probably heard of us. Inside Sweden's borders, I work for Ekru Consulting in Sveavägen, a specialist consulting company here. 6 weeks ago, I was the chief solutions architect for the Microsoft Western Europe consulting practice, and I've done a lot of work over the years with the integration with SOA, WCF. I was also the IoT tap lead for Western Europe. I'm going to pull all that experience together into this session today to try and predict the future and try and help you avoid the chaos that will surely come. So when we're talking about the future of distributed systems, I'm talking about a couple of different things, trends and technologies that are happening in the industry. Microservices is a big one, big buzzword, and we're going to try and focus on that and inject a little bit of reality into that discussion here today rather than just, you know, making it up as we go along. Actors, service fabric is important, API gateways, IoT is something that even if you're not working with it, it's shifting the sands on which we stand, it's changing the way we look at the world, ML. And there are two audiences I'm addressing with this session today. One audience is the people who work with enterprise application integration. How many of those guys are here? Four, okay. and developers. And so it's two different perspectives looking at the same thing. And both groups are going to have to change how they look at the world in order to succeed with this moving forward. This is a level 200 session. It means there isn't going to be any fireworks. There isn't going to be any code or any Visual Studio. It's more conceptual. And judging where we are as an industry right now with regards to microservices, I think that's where we've got to keep it before we get carried away with ourselves. So, a quick history lesson then. How did we get here? And I guess anyone who's seen any kind of session on microservices has seen this kind of thread running through them where we talk about monoliths and then how things are going to get better. Bear with me, this is a little bit more nuanced and a little bit of a different take on things. So, in the beginning, there were monoliths, and we built these huge, massive, single process systems that did everything. And at iDesign, we talk about the great big button click, where you have a button on a form and about 700 lines of code behind it. That's the kind of thing that usually leads into a discussion about microservices and how we solve this by breaking the system up into smaller and smaller components. But we're going to take a slightly different look at it today. And way back before we started to talk about microservices, we had enterprise application integration, where we had not just one monolith, but a whole bunch of monoliths inside our enterprises. And we solved the problem of their inflexibility by pulling business logic and integration logic centrally into an enterprise application integration platform, which from the Microsoft side of the room was BizTalk. But also WebSphere and TIBCO and Oracle had their solutions for this kind of thing. And a lot of organizations developed a capacity, which sometimes is called the integration team, sometimes it's called the integration competence center. They developed the capacity to deliver this across the enterprise, gathering functionality and data across a number of different systems to quickly, or sometimes not so quickly, deliver new functionality to the business. And this was very, very common. In fact, almost all large enterprises did this. And the enemy of this approach, of course, was coupling this idea that you could connect two of these monolithic systems directly to each other. And we all know that that way lies madness. That eventually, if you allow this to happen, things will get out of control. And instead of having one, or instead of having a collection of monoliths within your organization, you'll have one huge big monolith, all so interconnected that you can't possibly do anything new. And it will eventually stop your organization or your software from developing and growing with the business. And the guys in these integration teams and these integration competence centers became the heroes that had to protect the organization from coupling, from these things being coupled together. And normally when I go into a new organization, I would try and find these guys because they're the ones who've been doing real hardcore architecture over the years. They're the guys who know how queuing works. They know how to scale. They know how to deal with the enterprise level software problems and patterns. And so once these ideas had been established and these integration platforms became a common theme across enterprises across the world, around 2004, 2005, there was this trend that we all know was called SOA, so service-oriented architecture. And I divide that into two sections. One is called Big SOA. And Big SOA is what the consultancy companies tried to sell us. They tried to sell us these packages where consultants would come and tell us how to break our business down into a bunch of different services, big services that would, with the aim of reuse and composability, that would forever change the way we did business and bring agility to the enterprise, which of course didn't really work out like that, but it was a nice idea. And Big SOA then, from a vendor perspective, once we had this idea about all these services that we could build and do these things with, the vendors didn't really have any way of hosting these services, and so they were pushed into the existing enterprise application integration platforms like BizTalk and WebSphere suddenly became hosts for SOA services. And the idea, the fundamental idea behind the SOA service was an evolution of what had been happening within distributed computing. So before SOA, the idea was that when you had an object on one computer or a component and an object or a component on another computer, what everyone had tried to do was to get this object here, to call the object here, as if they were on the same machine. So everyone wanted a programming model that would mirror what happened when you had two objects on the same machine. SOA was the acceptance of the idea that these two objects actually lived on different machines and that it was okay. And it was okay to have an explicit network boundary between them. And they came up with a bunch of tenets around explicit boundaries and shared contract, not schema, and shared policy. And that's what SOA was. And then this idea was pushed into the enterprise application integration space because the vendors didn't have any answer to how do we host all of these services, which caused a lot of challenges, which we'll look at in a minute. What everyone missed, almost everyone missed, was the idea of little SOA. And that's when you have this object on a machine here and another object on a machine over here. And yes, you allow them to be separate. You embrace the tenets of SOA. You allow the boundaries to be explicit. But little SOA is when you take this object and you bring it back down to this machine and put it right beside this guy, but you still treat it as if it's on the network. And why would you do that? The reason you would do that is because it gives you a very clean separation of concerns. It separates your plumbing from your business code in a way that we hadn't seen before. And it gives you a programming model that's inherently much, much simpler. And when I say that we missed this, everyone was so focused on the big SOA piece and the composability and the reuse that we missed little SOA in the midst of all that. Except, of course, for iDesign and Yuval, who works at iDesign. He came up with the idea about 10 years ago that every class should be a service. And when he came up with that idea, he was pretty much laughed out of the building everywhere he went. Of course, now when you go to Wikipedia and look up microservices, you'll see his name there, and you'll see that he said it first, and he's not shy about pointing that out either. Some of you are laughing, so I guess you know him. So Little SOA was an evolution of these ideas, and something that that, as we'll see as we move through the deck, becomes very, very important. Now, the problem with the enterprise application integration platforms taking on the job of big SOA was that they weren't really very well equipped to do that, right? Things like BizTalk were not well equipped to host small instances of services because they forced their enterprise application integration patterns onto these little, small, lightweight services. Things like enforced queuing introduced latency, and it just became too complex. And also, the learning curve for BizTalk was really, really high, and that meant that developers had a hard time contributing because they had to learn, spend so much time learning before they could even build and deploy simple services. And there were also problems with scaling and hosting large amounts of services in these massive EAI platforms. And so I did some work 8 years ago now at the city of Stockholm, Stockholm Stad, where we were pulling together sort of 31 different departments and building e-services for the citizens of Stockholm. And we solved this problem by moving all these lightweight services, these big SOA services, out of the enterprise application integration stack and into and hosting them in their own environment. And that kind of approach brings its own problems, because how do you control that many services? And the pattern that we used is called service virtualization. Service virtualization involves taking your service and making a ghost of it and hosting that ghost of the service in a platform, so that your clients talk to the ghost and the ghost writes the message to the actual service. And that means that you have one platform for hosting all your endpoints, and in that platform, you can inject policy, you can do your own logging, you can add your own security, you can form that endpoint whatever way you want, no matter where that service is hosted, what language it's written in, or what protocol it runs over. And that approach enables a whole bunch of secondary patterns, like transport mediation, recording, auditing, SLA management, and it actually gave us a handle at the Stockholm Stad, where there were 300 services running, to be able to monitor and manage services running in disparate systems, in disparate monoliths, and it gave us a real edge in being able to solve that problem. And we did that eventually with a product called Centinet from a company called Nevatech based in Georgia. This is something we were doing 8 years ago, as I mentioned. This has just become a hot topic. You may have seen that Google have just bought a company called Apigee. Everyone is getting ready to move into this space. Martin Fowler recently wrote a blog article where he said that if you want to succeed with microservices, then you're going to have an API gateway strategy. I think that one of the things that we need to warn the community about is that API gateways have been trivialized. They're seen as an external facing function, but they're actually an incredibly powerful tool for managing services within the enterprise. And as we move towards enterprise level microservice architectures, we need these tools. So, once we'd gotten a handle of this at our customers and we started using service virtualization to manage all these different services, to allow our lightweight services to execute free of these massive monolithic ESB-based platforms, we noticed another pattern started to pop up. As we started to build new systems that would play a role in this massive service ecosystem, we noticed that we were planning ahead of time. So the old way of doing things was you built your monolith, you focused on the functions it had to achieve, you deployed it, then you came back 6 months later and you said, oh, this team needs access to this function, this team needs access to this data, and you built your integration outside of that project. What we started doing at our customers was that we started designing our systems with integration built in up front. And so we started thinking, well, someone's going to need access to this, and we should expose this as a service. And our monoliths started to look a little bit more like this, a structured set of services calling each other. And we started to pull in the ideas that I described in Little SOA, where we actually had services executing beside each other on the same machine, sometimes in the same process space, but we'll not get into all that kung fu today. And we called these SOA-aware applications at the time. If we were building these today, we would call them microservices. Yeah, because that's essentially what they were. And so when you put all of these ideas together that I've discussed over the last 15 minutes, I've come to this idea around federated integration. And for you guys, the four guys who put their hands up and said you work with enterprise application integration, this slide can be a bit scary. I've seen some fairly adverse reactions to it. But in the past, we had this idea of these monoliths all talking to the enterprise application integration monolith in the middle, which is the all-seeing, all-knowing integration platform. And then we moved to the idea of service virtualization, where we allowed the monoliths to host some of their own integration logic to expose services, and we could take care of those services through the virtualization platform. And you can see in this phase, the little EAI box gets a bit smaller. The responsibilities for enterprise application integration teams start to shrink. And that's not always seen as a good thing if you're the guys sitting on the enterprise application integration team, because nobody wants to see their job walk out the door. And that can lead to some conflict. When we start to look at these SOA-aware applications, these applications that provide their own services that are capable of providing more and more of the kind of capabilities that exist in an EAI platform inside their own runtimes, then we start to see the role of the enterprise application integration server fade into the background even more. And what we see in the future, this future of federated integration, are SOA-aware applications built up of many little SOA services that are capable of taking care of their own integration needs. These things can have queues in them. They can support long-running processes. They can do all these things, and they can do it in very few lines of code. In a way that makes it hard to justify the expense and the process heaviness of using a centralized monolithic ESB pattern. And this will be the future of integration. And as we take another few steps forward in another few years, the relationships between these services, the way they interact with each other, will be managed by things like spiders and bots and crawlers. And they'll gather data in monitoring systems like App Insights in the cloud, and eventually we'll see machine learning running on these algorithms over these patterns and telling you who's using what service, why they're using it, and what services you need to build next. And so this is my prediction of the future of integration, a future that's federated, that's less based on the monolithic application integration servers of today, and a future, if you're in that enterprise application integration team, is pretty scary. And so my message to the guys working within enterprise application integration is, don't be scared. Your job isn't going away. Just like we've had to tell the infrastructure guys who are scared of the cloud over the last couple of years, it's not going away. It's just going to get a little bit different. And I know it's very hard to resist that urge to pull back, to try and make things the way they were before. And if you're sitting on an enterprise application integration team, it's very easy to have a mandate over enterprise architecture at your company, because, like I said, these are the guys who really know how stuff works, who've worked at scale and done the heavy lifting over the last 10, 15 years. it's very easy to pull back and say, no, you have to do it this way. You have to go through the WebSphere instance. You have to use the WebSphere queues. And so I would say to the enterprise application integration guys, don't do that. Move with the flow. Embrace service virtualization as a more lightweight way to do integration and be prepared for the future. And be prepared to help the developers who are going to build these microservice applications, because just because they can turn on a queue or enable long-running processes with a couple of lines of code, it doesn't mean that they're going to do it particularly well, especially not the first 500 times. So there are a bunch of risks with this. Okay, the wild growth of Little SOA presents a threat, because we talked earlier about the EAI guys having the job of protecting the enterprise from coupling. And then all these monoliths started to be coupled together, it would be very, very dangerous. When monolithic applications start to be replaced by applications that can have literally hundreds of endpoints just hanging out there, the risk for that kind of coupling happening and the risk for it being crippling increase massively. And so someone needs to help the organization manage this transition from monolith to microservice, and that is the job of the enterprise application integration guys. And again, imposing some form of governance on this. You can get that governance with service virtualization. Like I said, it's becoming a hot topic. Google are getting into the game. All the big vendors are making moves. Microsoft is, of course, Azure API management. And you need to avoid this enterprise-wide big ball of mud, which will be the result of unrestricted Little SOA growth. And so after the history lesson, then we have to ask, why is this happening now? The most radical ideas that I've been presenting here are around Little SOA and microservice architectures and letting services run beside each other in the same machine. Why is it suddenly relevant now, today, and not 10 years ago when we first started talking about it? The reason that it's relevant is the new technologies that are popping up. And the first of these is cloud and microservices. So cloud is making everything easier. When I said you can create a queue with just a few lines of code, I'm referring, of course, to Service Bus. And as we'll see, there's a whole bunch of stuff coming in Windows Azure that makes building microservices much, much easier. Another thing that's pressing this forward is IoT. I spent a lot of time working with IoT at Microsoft, and I was one of the people who first started working with it at Microsoft. And one of the things I had to do there was to put together a couple of courses to teach our architects about IoT and how to work with IoT. And one of the things I told them as we were doing these courses was that you shouldn't be interested in IoT just because you like to play with your Arduino at home and mess around with your toaster and stuff like that. You should be interested in IoT because it is going to change the way we build software, because we went from building web applications and mobile applications to suddenly having to build applications that could handle millions of concurrent connections and data flows the like of which we'd never seen in enterprise applications. Another reason that this is important in the context of this conversation is that the enterprise application integration guys very early on tried to put themselves in the middle of the IoT discussion and say, we own this, no one else is allowed to do this. And you know what happens to a monolithic ESB when you suddenly put 5 million concurrent connections and a big flow of data to it? It just falls over. So IoT has been instrumental in giving us that little extra push forward and making us say, you know what, there's another question that needs to be answered here. Another thing that's also very important about IoT in this context is at this back end here where you see business integration connectors and gateways. Everybody gets carried away with IoT and the fun of connecting up all these devices and the analytics and the predictiveness and all those kind of things. The vast majority of work in an IoT project is integration. A very common use case within IoT is that if a company sells you a widget, and you have that widget and you love it and you carry it around, and suddenly it gets sick and you call up the company and you come through to a customer service representative and they ask you your name and they put your name into their CRM system and your name comes up. A lot of companies want the widget to be talking to the CRM system in real time, telling them why it doesn't feel well or why it's not working. And that's a pretty tall order for a lot of CRM systems. And so with IoT, we have a pretty big integration job that needs to be done. And so it plays in to all of these things that we've been looking at so far. Another trend and another thing that Windows Azure is making much easier to implement is actors. Is anyone working with actor model programming? Yeah. Four guys again. The actor model is a model of computing that allows us to efficiently take advantage of multiple processors. It's something that's become very important in IoT because it allows us to make what Amazon called twins of our devices, and it presents a whole bunch of new patterns within the microservice space, and it's something that is becoming very, very trendy. A lot of people are building applications like that with it right now. A lot of people are building them in a very strange fashion, so there's going to be some problems there. But it is one of the technologies that's driving this march towards microservices. And actors can be seen as a true implementation of microservices, where we have single instances at the smallest granularity running in real time. But the biggest thing that we need to be aware of in this space is the Azure Service Fabric. How many of you have done any work or touched Azure Service Fabric? Okay. So we'll not go too deep on this, but Service Fabric is a technology that lots and lots of Azure components are actually running on today, things like Service Bus and IoT Hub. They're actually running on Service Fabric. And you can think of Service Fabric in two ways. One way, it's an absolutely fantastic hosting platform that allows us to host services in a way that we can make them scalable, we can make them redundant, we can make them resilient. And all of those things that we really struggle to do with IIS or self-hosting, all of that stuff, all of that kung fu that we had to do ourselves to make reliable services, that's all done for us in Service Fabric. Another thing it gives us is a programming model that allows us to build services, reliable services, and actor-based services using the virtual actor pattern very, very, very quickly. And so Service Fabric is a fantastic technology, and it will also allow developers who maybe don't have that great level of depth within distributed systems to very, very quickly build distributed systems. And this is going to be one of the most important technologies released in the next couple of years. So if you haven't started working with Service Fabric and reading about Service Fabric and learning about it, now is a good time. Because in a few years' time, almost all applications will run on top of this. So the trick over the next couple of years, as we move away from these ideas about monoliths, and there are a lot of monolithic systems out there that are 12 to 15 years old, that are reaching the end of their lives, and it's time to replace them with something, and the answer is obviously going to be microservices because it's really hyped. Combining all of these technologies and all of these ideas is going to be tricky to get right. And in a world where more and more businesses are moving towards the digital, and we've all heard about digital transformation, right? Time to market is going to be important. Getting this right first time is going to be important. And so we need to be aware of the risks. As these applications take responsibility from the enterprise application guys and give it to the developers, we need to be aware of the risks involved in doing that. We're going to need governance. We're also going to need to control the design process, and you need to manage the integration risk, because we're moving integration from that central monolith out to the applications themselves, and that presents risk to us because it happens in an uncontrolled fashion. And so there are two things we need to do to control this risk. One is to use service virtualization in order to give us that enterprise level governance and control over these endpoints that we expose from our applications. And the other is the design process. We need to control the design process for these microservices, or else we're going to lose the run of our enterprise architectures. The microservices idea has been around for long enough that we're starting to see microservice-based architectures pop up at customers, and I've been involved in a good few reviews of these. And very often what we see is that someone will take an object-oriented application and just put a HTTP endpoint on every single class. And yeah, it happens. I guess some people are laughing. I hope because you've read about it, not because you've done it. It is happening everywhere, and it's really nasty when that happens. And what we're also seeing is a proliferation of applications that are being broken down into smaller and smaller components without any thought behind why. What should a microservice look like? How do we break these down? And if you take object-oriented ideas and try and transpose them directly into this, you just end up with an absolute mess of an application. And so decomposition is probably the primary skill for architects. It probably always has been, but as we move into microservice-based architectures, decomposition becomes insanely important. If we don't do this right, we're going to lose the match. At iDesign, we have a bunch of courses, the Architects Masterclass and the Architecture Clinics that will let you spend a couple of weeks practicing these skills, how to break a system down into its constituent parts. But essentially, the biggest step is that we need to stop thinking in terms of applications. And so I'm going to introduce you to a few ideas that might seem completely spaced out and completely wacky. But remember, everyone laughed at us 10 years ago when we said every class should be a service. And now we're here talking about microservices, so bear with me. So when we started to build these SOA-aware applications, we started coming up with designs that avoided the need for integration after the fact. And that saved customers a lot of grief and a lot of money, and it made things quite easy for us. And so I noticed when I attempted to answer the question, how do you design a solution that avoids integration after the fact, that I didn't really have a good answer to it. So I started to write these ideas down. And I packaged all these ideas under the title of Flow First Design. And the paper that I wrote on this, which I didn't dare to publish because it just felt too far out back in 2011, that's the reason I work at iDesign today. Because I sent it to iDesign and they said, well, this is the right sort of stuff. So the basic premise of Flow First Design is that instead of modeling our domain, instead of modeling a database, instead of going after verbs and nouns, we first model our application in terms of information that flows from outside the system to inside the system, and we write down the number of flows that happen in the application, and we do our best to keep these information flows separate from each other, because every time we cross an information flow, we're actually creating an integration point in the application. And if you think about an online store that sells bicycles, first of all, you have this flow, which is called order bicycle. And that's information that comes from me that says, my name's Barry, and I want the red bike with the big wheels and the bell. And it comes into the application. And here you see these guys, these little services that take care of the business logic in order bicycle. And what we do in Flow First Design is we go absolutely crazy and we say, every single one of these services gets an in queue and an out queue. So every message that comes in goes into a queue, gets processed by the service, and gets put on an outgoing queue. You can be picked up by the next service. So essentially, we're building a little tiny ESB inside every flow. And data, then. Data is completely separate from the flow. And the premise here is that for far too long as developers, we've been mixing up data storage with process execution, and we force our applications to behave according to the restrictions of a relational database that's actually built for reporting. So we separate database from the flow. And we say, if you want to fill a database with data for reporting, then that database takes a subscription on one of the queues and fills its data from there. And then if we have another process that perhaps our original process is dependent on, another flow, let's say add new bike to catalog. This is where we update our catalog of bikes and say, now we are selling yellow bikes with big wheels. Then if we need data from that service, then we create a little data store inside Order Bicycle that lives in there and is owned by that process, and it takes a subscription on the queue of add new bike to catalog. And that way, we don't have an integration point between those two flows. And this way, we can build an application, theoretically, that requires no integration across its process flows. And if we put decent endpoints on each process, we have an application that avoids the need for integration at all. And if we need to integrate with these systems, we just take a subscription on a queue and we have their data, we have access to their functionality through the endpoints, and suddenly if you work in enterprise application integration, the world starts to look a little bit scary, that you might not be needed anymore. So my question to you all then is this a good way to build your systems? Does anyone want to dare to answer? No. This is not a good way to build your systems. This is absolutely crazy. Only a lunatic would build all their systems like this. And only a lunatic who's done it could say that so emphatically. The point of this exercise is not to say this is how we build systems. The point of this exercise is to make design decisions that are transparent and conscious. So once we've designed a system in this way, we then go through this architecture and we take away every component that doesn't actually add any value to the business. So these queues and these subscriptions give us a lot of agility and a lot of flexibility if there's business process changes. But if we know in our guts, and we know from, because we know our own domains, that there aren't going to be any changes, then we can take these components away. And we call this the shoestring method, where we tighten the knot of the application. And eventually, our application could look like this. Two objects talking to a database. So this isn't a prescriptive method, this is a design methodology. What it means is that if you do decide to have two objects talking to a database, which is essentially a monolith, at least you've gone through this process, you can justify it. Every single decision that you've made as an architect is recorded, and you can say this application looks the way it does because of this, this, and this. And it's justified architecture. And on the same note, if you go back to this slide, if you build something absolutely crazy like this, as an architect, you then have to say it looks like this because we need to do this, this, and this, and we need this level of flexibility. If you follow this kind of design process, you will mitigate the risk of your developers running away with the microservices idea and going to town on it. And you'll reduce the risks of failure in microservice architecture substantially. And that's why I'm saying that of the two key things you need to control in order to manage microservice architectures, your design process is probably the most important. And this is something that I was doing in the United States last week. I was working with a customer, and this is a real life example of flow first design. We found two processes that were important to them. They were dependent on each other. We modeled them according to flow first design. We took away almost all the queues in the data stores. And once we've done that, you can actually start putting component names in Windows Azure onto the pieces that you need. So this is a real, this isn't just theory or fantasy. This is a technique that's actually delivering value to this customer by helping them very quickly get to an architecture when they were confused about how to get there, in a way that made it very easy for their architects to then explain to the business why these decisions had to be made. And so to summarize the process then is you identify your independent process flows in your application. You design a solution with the least amount of coupling possible. You use ideas, old ideas, like subscriptions and durable queues to share that information between them. Your last step is to add your data stores for reporting and archiving, pull the shoestring, and then record and justify every single decision that you make. If you follow a process like this, then you will drastically reduce the risks that microservice architectures present to your enterprise architecture. Like I said, I put these ideas together in 2011. I never published them, and I never published them because I was chicken, because I just didn't want to take the heat of having to defend these ideas, which at the time would have seemed really radical, because I seen the amount of heat that the other guys at iDesign were getting for pushing the idea that every class should be a service. But if we look at what's happening now, this is the IoT reference architecture from Microsoft. And if we look at everything in the red band here, what we're actually seeing is a flow of information. An IoT the IoT reference architecture and IoT architectures are based around inflows of information into the system and taking those flows and pointing them in different directions and doing different things with them. So that idea wasn't that far-fetched. The other idea is like having a queue for every single service. Well, that's actually central to the actor model. Every actor has a mailbox. Having data stores right beside your services, that's actually something that's made incredibly easy in Service Fabric. And so the idea is, even the extreme architecture, even that extreme version, which I said we probably shouldn't build, the technology to do that exists today, those ideas aren't that crazy. And so I think that the ideas around flow-first design actually give you a really credible design process to just find that right spot on the scale of where your microservice architecture should be. So I've mentioned actors a few times, and my honest opinion on this is that the actor model absolutely presents a fantastic way to take advantage of the concurrency in a platform like Windows Azure. I also think that the ideas aren't quite mature yet. We're still learning as an industry how applicable this is. You know, there's going to be blood on the floor before we get to the final set of patterns and ideas around the actor model and what it can and can't be used for. It's certainly going to be overused in a lot of cases. The work that I've been doing at the minute is basically reading and researching on this, and this is one of the best books out there. Now, I know that this is a Microsoft conference, but most of the work around the actor model has been done in Scala and Akka. And this book actually goes through how you would implement every single one of the patterns in this very famous book, Enterprise Integration Patterns, using the actor model. And this is something that is a really good exercise for getting more familiar with the actor model and also getting familiar with how these things can impact enterprise application integration. Because if you work in that EAI space, this book is your Bible. Yeah. An example of how powerful the actor model actually can be is the case of orchestration dehydration. This is something that all the big EAI platforms do. The ability to host a long-running service that's initiated by one message that goes to sleep, gets woken back up with another message, and continues its execution. This is a primary feature of these big platforms. The actor model actually allows you to do this, to do orchestration dehydration inside your own application in a couple of lines of code. And that's built into the actor model. So one of the biggest, toughest, hardest to build features of these EAI platforms becomes a couple of lines of code in the actor model. And that's why I think it's worth paying attention to that as well. And so putting all this together, then we have IoT, which is pushing at the boundaries of what our systems can do, pushing massive influxes of data and bringing its integration challenges, challenging the EAI patterns and the ESB monolith patterns. We have Service Fabric, which is going to make it easier to do all of these things quickly and easily in very few lines of code. It'll make it easy for our developers to do this. We have legacy systems. We have our old enterprise application integration platforms. Now, don't get me wrong, these things aren't going away. They're going to be around for another 10 years, but their role and their influence is going to shrink. And we're also going to have microservice-based architectures popping up in our organization. We're also going to have software as a service popping up and exposing its endpoints in much the same way. And a lot of these things will behave like SOA aware or little SOA applications. And the two things that we need, one is a service virtualization platform to cope with federated integration. And the other thing we need, you'll see down at the bottom here, is the design process to make sure that our microservice architectures are justified and that we're not just reacting to trends. And I've mentioned this already, and you can't have a talk these days without mentioning digital transformation. It's almost a clause in the contract. The kind of business model innovation that customers are expecting from IT consultants and from their own IT departments today requires incredibly fast movement. That means being able to build applications incredibly quickly. That means that your applications that you build also need to be able to respond to change incredibly quickly. And it's not enough to just stand up at your meetings and say that you're agile. You have to actually be able to respond to change quickly. The kind of platform that I'm talking about today, based on Service Fabric, based on actor model patterns, can make that possible. And so, we're almost there now. I know this is pretty dense. The takeaways, enterprise application integration is not going to continue as it is today. And any attempt by EAI teams to stay in the past is just going to slow the organization down. So if you work within enterprise application integration, start to embrace the ideas around federated integration that I've presented here today. Start to prepare yourself for the future and prepare not to lose your job or lose face or lose power within your organization, but prepare to be the champion of structured, solid, dependable microservice architectures within your organization, because your organization will need you. And finally, you need a design methodology in order to succeed with this. So if you have any questions, I know this is confusing. If you're inside Sweden, then it's ECRU. Look, it's my company in Sweden. Outside Sweden, it's iDesign. If you're interested in courses on the decomposition, I'm going a lot deeper with that decomposition and how to get to what is a microservice and how do I define a microservice and how do I decide how many microservices should be in my application, then go to idesign.net or shoot me an email. Actually, you can shoot me an email at either addresses. I won't be fussy. Like, I'll read everything that comes in. So, thank you.